I left Hull about 5 o'clock and I got there about 10:30. And the NCO in charge of the guard promptly shoved me in the cells because the guard room, because I was supposed to be in at 10 o'clock, according to him. But it didn't say 10 o'clock on my pass, so I just had to report on, was it January the 7th, I believe. Anyhow, in the morning, nothing's done to me, and while I'm in that night, I heard a familiar voice, and it was George Leake, one of the gunners out of my own subsection, who heard me coming, you see, with my voice. And he'd arrived sometime, you know, an hour or two earlier, a bit earlier. And it seems he'd been wounded after me and been in a different hospital, you see, so a shorter time. He'd arrived that same night. But however, the next day...
I think we'd better concentrate on one thing at a time. Mm. What I'm trying to get out of you now is why you regarded the Northern Command Depot as so bad that you were happy to get back to France. What was it?
Well, the next day, all the newcomers were in before a standing medical board. There were two or three officers there, and you filed past them. They were examining, I think about 100 in an hour at their age. You went before them, and they said, what's the matter with you? And I said, gunshot wounds in the arm, in the neck and the jaw and the back. And they said, was I all right? I said, I couldn't open my jaws properly yet. So he then said to me, well, go down to Market Square in Ripon this evening. He said, do you know it? I said, no, sir. I said, I only arrived last night in the dark, in a snowstorm, and matter of fact. So we'll go down there, he says, find the prettiest girl you can. He says, take her down a dark passage and get her to tickle you under the chin. He said, you'll soon open your jaw then. That's as true as I sit here. That's the advice he gave me. Yeah. Next one. And I went on. Bloody disgusting.
Well, what else was so bad about the place?
Well, you were... Rivale, at 7 o'clock in the morning, and you had to go out in the snow, as it was then, doing PT before breakfast. And some of these men were in there, they'd been suffering from malaria in the, you know, in hot climates. Take them out in the snow like that. There was, I think, about 90 sergeants there out of a total of 600 or 700 men. What were all those sergeants doing there? The officer in charge, he was an old dugout.
Yeah.
Been retired God knows how many years and come back into the army. And he was all spit and polish, parade and that kind of thing. He came on parade one day, I've forgotten what he had to tell us, but he marched up and down like Napoleon for a minute or two, with his hand across his chest like this, you see, and then he suddenly turned on and says, you men, he says, with what honour and glory on the fields of battle in France and Flanders, get how I wish I could have been with you. And he banged his fist like, we gaped open mouth, you silly old devil. So, the rations were simply appalling.
Worse than on the front?
Yes, definitely. For dinner, we used to get some days cold. The rations were simply appalling.
Worse than on the front?
Yes, definitely. For dinner, we used to get some days cold tinned rabbit, Australian tinned rabbit, and a soggy boiled potato. And this culminated one day in literally a mutiny.
Tell me about that. What happened?
When the ordnance officer came round, everybody was bombarding him, you know, with complaints. And so his name was Captain P.W.M. Bate, B.A.T.E., I can remember that. And the lieutenant who was with him, our section lieutenant, was off the fish dock, you know, but I can't remember his name. And so he came back with this colonel and the sergeant major. And the colonel got up on the form to address us. There was about 500 or 600 men in that big concrete dining hall. And he started to speak. And they started rattling their knives and forks when they found he wasn't going to give us anything on the tin plates. The potato was colder by then, so it didn't matter. It couldn't get any colder. And the sergeant major shouted to some to stop it, you see. With that, somebody threw a potato from behind and hit him at the back of the neck with his potato. And that was a signal. There was a fusillade of wet boiled potatoes at them, and their retreat in disorder was potatoes splattered over them. And so there was a deathly silence after that. And after an interval, Captain Bate came back. He was a decent chap. And he got on the phone and he said, I'm sorry you've taken the action which you have done, although we sensed that he agreed with us, you see. He said, I'm making arrangements to have another meal ready for you, see. And if you just wait, and it'll be served as soon as possible, you see, something like that.
So this was not only a mutiny, but it was a successful mutiny.
Yes, we got a better meal than we'd had before, you see. Mm. So then, a night or two later, I suppose, in revenge, by the way, with no fires, they stopped that. They said the fuel situation was such, we couldn't have any fires. So, we were out on parade in the morning, we came back, sergeants, mess and officers, mess, they've got stoves going like hell, smoke going up, and we couldn't have one. So we used to raid the coal store, 6 o'clock in the morning, draw lots, you know, to take turns each time, and climb over there, you see. The sentries were in with us, you see. They never stopped us, and raid the coal store, and get coal like that. But about 2 o'clock in the morning, it was snowing again, the bugle started going. The corporal was in the next bed to me, he says, what's that? So I said, it's the bloody fire call. Because we were trained on the bugling calls, you see, in 1915, although we didn't use them in France, of course. I said, what's on fire in the middle of a snowstorm? However, we sat tight, and we could hear sounds of activity outside, you know, and shouting and going on, and then eventually the sergeant major came in. What the hell are we all? We hadn't moved, you see, so everybody was out waiting, so we got dressed and went outside, you see. They're all lined up there, everybody shivering. And then this old so-and-so started to address us again in the snowstorm about discipline and such as that at 2 o'clock in the morning. Well, after a bit, the rear ranks began to melt away in the snowstorm. You see, finally, they reckon he was left addressing the front rank only, who couldn't get away. Well,
what was the outcome of that?
Oh, he couldn't do much, really.
It sounds as if you had something close to complete anarchy on the
camp. It was. John Bull took this lot up. You were not allowed to, if you were found with a copy of John Bull, that was an offence. You were not allowed to send anything home, you see.
Why was John Bull regarded as...
Because he took up the cudgels on our behalf, you see. Somebody had written to him, it seems. But Horatio Bottomley, you won't remember that, John Bull. It was a paper which was... Horatio Bottomley was, he got time at finish. He was a twister, but by God, he got things done, weren't during his time. And you were not allowed to send parcels of some kind. I just forget what it was now. So they all had to be censored. Oh, that was it. All your parcels had to be censored, sir. Right, monkey. The troops all have an answer, you know. So what they did, they started sending sweaty, mucky socks on, and the officers had to open the for sweaty socks inside. There was a chap in our hut, a Jew. He'd suffered badly from trench feet, you know, and trench fever, that sort of thing. He could barely hobble, and there used to be a travelling medical board come every fortnight, I think. And this chap, he goes before this TMB, as we called it. He thought he'd get his discharge, because he was useless. And everything was going well, until one of these officers said, are you a Jew? And he said, yes, sir. Oh, B2, service abroad, says, go to Khartoum and die there or something like that, you see. Well, somebody, Joseph, who became a knight later, he was in Parliament at the time, and his people wrote to him and took the case up like that. But before anything more could be done, this chap died in the hut. We couldn't wake him when we came back one from parade one day. He was hut orderly, you see, because he couldn't go on parade, he couldn't walk hardly. He was in a coma, so I know the RAMC came and took him away, and he died.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they wanted this hushed up. They wouldn't give his people a free warrant to come up to the funeral, you see. They wanted to bury him quick. We had a whip round and sent money down there to get his people up there, you see. But right before then, I'd gone, so I don't know what happened afterwards. Is that the end?
And these experiences at Ripon that you've been telling me about made you want to get back to France.
Yes, yes. Well, I volunteered for France to get away from there.
Yeah. What steps did you take at Ripon to get away?
Every week, at the Standing Medical Board, when they asked me what was the matter with me, how I was going on, I told them nothing. I was ready to go back to France.
Hmm.
So you started at category about 4B, and you're marked up, say, 4A, and so until you get to about category 2. I was marked up one each week until I was in a high enough category to be discharged. And then I went down to Fort Fareham. I hadn't put my flags up because I thought, well, I wasn't in love with the idea of going over the top unarmed with the infantry, just to signal back information and being shot at and not being able to shoot back. So I thought, I'll stay as a gunner this time. So all went well for a short time until eventually one day they asked on parade, anyone know anything about motors and motorcycles? So I thought, oh, this is something. And I was keenly interested, so I stepped forward. And the next thing I knew, there were five of us who'd volunteered. We were sent down to some other place nearby to interview an officer from the Army Service Corps, MT, Mechanical Transport, which had just been formed. And they were wanting staff for that. So I thought, well, I'll find out what's going on. So I lined up last man, you see, it was before we marched in, but unfortunately, we didn't turn the same way. And I'm become number one instead of number five. And there was a lieutenant colonel there, asked us what we knew of some elementary questions about internal combustion engines. I said, well, this is ridiculous. Had I had a secondary school education? I said, yes. Two of us out of the five had had secondary school education. Then we were blandly informed, without any asking us, that we were to be transferred to an OTC preparatory to taking up a commission in the Mechanical Transport Section of the Army Service Corps. The other three were to be, you know, become mechanics. I said, well, oh, this is a bit of a devil. I said, well, I could not afford to have a commission in those days. It was regarded as being the prerogative of people with money. So I thought, well, I'm not having that. And that was the only way to get out of this. When I got back during the dinner hour to me Fort Fareham, when I paraded at afternoon parade, I very ostentatiously paraded in the front rank with my crossed flags on. Of course, that was soon spotted. Two paces stepped forward, and before he could bat an eyelid, I'm shoved off to the signal depot, you see.
Where was that?
Well, first of all, I go to Abington, not Abington Park.
That's what you've got down here, Abington Park.
Abington Park.
Mm.
Oh, that's right, yes. Mm. And but I'm only there a short time. But in that time, we have, in that short time, we have quite an interesting experience. I find several of the old battery already there. Amongst them is Sid Reynolds, the artificer, and one or two more, and it seems a short of a outside left in the battery football team. There's about 800 men in this. It is a 4th Reserve heavy battery. And there's about 800 odd men there. And they haven't got an outside left. So eventually I'm persuaded to chip in, you see. And I start playing football with them. I've no boots. But I soon find some. And the there's a few horses arrive one day, and so I take charge of one of those, to my sorrow. She's they've been at Remount Depot weeks and weeks, everything, which they just go wild, and this mare was on heat, and she was absolutely vicious. Had a hell of a time with it. However, we come to a football match, and we do very well. There's one of these chaps who's in the hut, his name is Brown. He's a man of about 36 or 7, and I find out in conversation with him that he's a West End masseur in London. He's been drafted under the Derby scheme, you see, sort of the scrape in the barrel by then, 1917. And he's a masseur. I thought, well, this is what we want for the football team. So he doesn't like horses. So all right, I just have a word to him. I said, what about looking after the football team? He said, oh, I'd be delighted. So I got in touch with the officer, Major Jenkins, and, all right, this chap Brown is put in charge of all the physical part of it, you see. Well, finally we enter a six-a-side tournament. The London Irish are promoting a big sports do, and amongst these there's a six-a-side football contest, you see. Well, of course, the accent is on speed there alone. So I'm playing on the left hand of the front three, you see. The centre forward is McEwen of Clyde. The football team we had there, by the way, 9 out of the 11 were English Scottish League pros, one of them international. And I've got a photograph there somewhere. So we win this tournament right through to the final. And then we go to the prize giving. I'm rather amused because each man stepping up for his prize to be presented by the general's wife, as if he's drawing his pay, you know, saluting, two paces step forward, and then two paces back and salute again, whatever it is in hand. Well, Max, our captain, so he steps forward and gets 6 10-shilling notes. Now, somebody got out of earshot. He let rip his effing and branding a little bit. He works out how long he's played. 4 rounds at 10 minutes each way, and a semi-final and a final at 15 minutes each way, for 10 shillings. He thought he was playing for £3 a man. It was £3 for the six of us. I was well satisfied. It was 2 weeks' wages for me, because I was only on 1 and 2 and 8 a day, out of which 3 and 6 months allocations for the mother's allowance, you see. So I was getting about $1 a week. And I'd had an afternoon's football and got paid for it. I was highly satisfied.
You passed on to Winnledown Signal Training School. Mm. Why was it necessary for you to go back to a training school? I mean, you were already a qualified signaller.
Search me. I went in there and had to go through all the lot again. And I played football there again. The officer was Mr. Blake, Lieutenant Blake. And he appealed every day for outside left. And on the last day of the week, I stood up. So I'm putting the team the following day. They haven't any proper sized boots for me. They're too big. We play the Royal West Kents, I remember. And we won, but I've forgotten the score. So the following week, I'd sent home to Hull to my youngest uncle, father's youngest brother, who was a keen sportsman, and he got me a pair of boots with proper size and sent them down. So the following week I played, and in my opinion I had a good game. We won I think 3-0 or 3-1, something like that, and the full-back behind me was doing very nicely for me when he found I wanted the ball put in front for me to run it, because of my only asset was speed. I had no ball control, but I could run. So he was showing this ball well past the defence and me racing onto it, you see, and then dropping the centres in from right off the line. Mm. Did very well. So the following week, my name isn't on the team sheet. Oh, that's funny. Anyhow, I went to see the match. Didn't say anything, went to see the match. And the man in my place, his name is Downey. And so I'm talking to one of the chaps on the touchline. I watched this chap play. He's not as...
What interests me about Winnledown Signal Training School is whether the training that you went through there differed in any way from your original training.
This Downey had been on a fortnight's leave, and he was a Scottish international. They only wanted him on to replace him for a fortnight. Mm. No, the training was, differed in some respects. There was one or two later things had come in, you see.
What kind of things?
Fuller phone, maybe. That was a thing.
You mentioned the fuller phone earlier in France, so that must have been the same.
No, we didn't have the fuller phone. Not on the first trip in France, I don't think. In the second trip. Mm. But however, I passed out there with it. I'd only one error in the whole of the season. That was when the chap was reading out. I was standing with the flag, you see, and he was a Geordie, and A and E sound very similar in Geordie language, and I sent the wrong letter, because I didn't know until afterwards, but I said, I knew then, he didn't send it. But however, the written examination, so on the telephone, and all that sort of thing, you know, and we were in a big hut for that, and there was an examining officer come from another unit, you see, and two other officers walking around. Well, I've filled in all the questions. There's 11 questions, and I've filled them all in on both papers in about 20 minutes. And he came round to me and says, get on with it. He said, I've finished. So he took him up to the examining officer, and he came back and he said, well, I'm only supposed to answer 9 out of the 11. And so I'll strike out 2. And so I said, well, strike out what you like. And so, you know, he turned me out then.
Mm-hmm.
And I passed out with the highest marks that had ever been attained in that school.
Mm-hmm.
But the funny thing was, the first day I was on parade, there was a little sergeant pulled me out. I got my flags up, you see. He pulled me out.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was brought up before the old man, the charge was wearing the flags.
Yeah.
Before I'd passed out, you see. And I said, well, I passed out 2 years ago.
Now, you returned to France in, let me see, May 1917, so you'd been away about 8 or 9 months, and you joined the 144th Heavy Battery.
Mm.
Was the 144th an identical kind of battery to the 4th Heavy?
The 4th...
After you returned to France, you went to Le Havre.
Mm.
Mutinies seem to follow you around a bit. What was the one at Le Havre prompted by?
By the conditions on this bullring, the appalling things you're supposed to do. I mean, you'd have to be trained athletes to do some of those activities.
Well, tell me what the bullring was and what the exercises were.
It was a course. You'd go around it, climbing over obstacles, jumping, and one of the jumps was off a raised part. You had to jump across a water jump, and I could just about do it. Mind you, I could jump. In that camp at Ripon, we're doing it there. Mm. And I jumped 18 feet in the hook, beat even the instructor. It's been a fellow called Horn from Devon, and he wasn't pleased about it either. The two of us both beat him. But a lot of these older men, they fell in the water. That was to the great glee of these instructors.
Did you have to go through this course yourself?
Yes, yes. Mm. Everybody had to go there. Every morning you were up there. It was absolutely, it was like a penance sort of thing. And that's what the row was about. Some of them refused to do it.
How did the row develop? Did you hear about it?
No, they just refused to do it, that's all. They turned out, I think it was either the Scottish or the South Africans refused, and they turned out the others to sort of intimidate them, and they joined them. But what happened, I don't know. We didn't get to know about it.
Now, you rejoined the 144th Heavy Battery. Mm. Was that battery different in any ways from the 2nd Heavy? Had anything changed?
They were not as well trained, because they were not formed until a year after the others, see? And they didn't get anything like the period of time in which to do the training. So, when I got there, and it took a bit of getting there too, we got up to Bayeux during the early hours of the morning, and this was the day of the Battle of Messines started. It was about about a week into June, like that, the 6th or 7th or 8th of June, something like that it would be. And there was guards there, and me and another lad were taken to this brigade headquarters in the early hours of the morning, and we were informed that this battery, the 144 that we were destined for, had been transferred to another brigade at 6 o'clock the evening before. This is preparatory to the Battle of Messines, eventually. And so they wouldn't have anything to do with us. Well, the guy had done his job, he'd taken us where he was told to do, and that was it, so we were left loose. And in the early morning, suddenly all hell broke loose. I mean, all guns going, and these mines went up, you see. This lad hadn't been out before. It frightened me, the racket that was going on. Well, we wandered about all day trying to find this battery.
This was during the course of the battle?
During the course of the battle, all the time. Yes. Well, there wasn't a lot of stuff coming back, not that I could see. But there was plenty going out. And we went back to this brigade headquarters that we'd been to once before. I've forgotten which one it was. Where this battery was supposed to have gone to, you see, but they didn't know where they were. And while we were there, this was in the evening, Sergeant Wynne, as it turned out to be, from the battery we were destined for, he arrived, and this other sergeant said, there's 2 recruits here for you, and so he took us back. And they were at a place called Dranoutre, D-R-A-N-O-U-T-R-E. And we handed over to the pay corporal, Baxter, and he put us in his... Daddy had a tent, and we put us in there for a time, and this other lad, Thomas, was dead beat. So, because we'd been 2 days and a night in the train. So, just then I had a order yell out for numbers one. That's the sergeant's, I mean, he's gone, you see, the number one. And so, this Thomas is just beginning to unpack his kit. I says, hold on a minute, I says, shouting for numbers one for nothing. A few minutes later, the order comes out, you hear him shouting, A subsection hook in, B subsection hook in, you know, that sort of thing. And we're on the march again. Didn't know where we were going. So anyhow, we got well up front. Walked, kept dropping back and dropping back and dropping back until finally we're behind the water cart, which brings up the rear, because a six-gun battery on line of march takes up about half a mile of road. All that. And the captain is riding behind, or was the major riding in front, the captain behind. And it's beginning to get... towards dawn then. So he rode up and he said, by then I was carrying this little kid's kit. I didn't know then, he was 28, he was the Bantam Battalion, as well, but they were transferring signals from the infantry to the artillery to replace the heavy losses in signals that we were incurring, you see, through line mending on long lines. And asked him if he could ride, and he said no. So I said, well, told him to get up, stop the last wagon and told him to get up on the box seat, you see. And he asked me, could I ride? And so I said, yes, sir. And so they put this kit in this wagon, and I took his horse. And he walked alongside. I never forgot that.
Mm.
And we got to Flamantinge.
So when you were... at Krustrat,
mm-hmm.
near Ypres, and preparing for the Passchendaele attack, did the artillery methods there vary from what they'd been earlier?
No, we were doing mostly counter-battery work and strapping roads for transport. That was the job of the 60-pounders as a rule. We were to observe from Hussar Farm, which was going the upper floor, you see. There was no ground... put it this way. The upper floor, the boards were all gone. We had to get up a staircase, which was hanging on by the wall, and walk around the edge where the floor was still, you know, to some extent attached to the wall, to get round to the window. In the middle, there was a heap of boards and brickwork and slates, you know, tiles and things, was from up, completely open up above. It was just a wreck. And we didn't learn until later there was a couple of dead mules underneath it until the horsefly started getting busy. But some artillery, I suppose, field artillery, used to bring their ammo up on a pair of horses, you see, a pair of mules, instead of having a limber. Because if a limber was brought and one pair of horses got knocked out, then the whole thing was a shambles. Whereas the... you had your horses separated, you used to lead them up and then ride them back. And then this fellow had gone off the road during the night for shelter and been hit. And that was it. Well, the man was there, I have no idea, but the horses certainly were. The stink was terrible.
Mm. Now, after a couple of weeks of general artillery work, the actual bombardment prior to Passchendaele, was that different from any, in any way from the earlier bombardments?
No, I don't think so. It was... well, they put over a sufficient fire to try and keep him... quiet, you see, while our fellows got over the top. But of course, you couldn't do much with these pillboxes, you see. At that time, Jerry got a lot of these pillboxes. They were round, like a hemispherical in shape, made of reinforced concrete, and shells just bounced off them very, very often. And then when our fellows went over me, these fellows, there were slits in these places, and the machine guns firing through there, so it was just... you've got to actually get into the place and throw bombs in it before you could subdue them. You couldn't subdue them in any other way. You've got to bomb your way out of it.
Mm.
That's why it was so costly.
Do you have any recollections of what the conditions were like at Passchendaele?
Yes. The attack started on July 31st, and they used the tanks. Well, at that situation... the natural drainage of this absolutely flat country had been destroyed, The ground was thoroughly waterlogged. Shell holes had water in them to within a foot of the surface, and the tanks just got hopelessly bogged down. We moved our guns up from the crew strat through Ypres onto the Menin Road in front. I don't know where they were going to, but before they got there, they were turned back. And we came back to our original position and had to turn out some Australians to put our guns back in position and back in action again. But we did move up a few days later. And we took up a position on the right of Menin Gate, in front of the ramparts, in front of the moat. And we were there from that date, July 31st, for the next few weeks. And the activity there was such that we never, I don't think, had six guns in action all at once. There was always one, if or more, down at Saint-Omer, having a new liner put in. Because the nominal life of a 60-pound was supposed to be 3,000 rounds, and we were going up to 5,000 and over. But as we were firing 1,000 rounds a night, average, out of the four guns, you can imagine it wasn't long before a gun had fired its 3,000 or 4,000 rounds within about a fortnight. I mean, 3 weeks they wanted relining in. Yeah. So that we were always one or two guns short. And the observation post from that point was at Jasper Farm. So that was a Jerry pillbox. There had been a farm there someday, no doubt, but all we had was a Jerry pillbox, with the entrance, of course, facing the enemy. First time I saw it, I didn't like it one little bit. There was two or three dead Jerrys in the trench, approach trench outside. As we found out later, there was another couple underwater inside it, and the stink was abominable. So we would have to go up to that place about every other night, money it. And one night, we'd been there, we should have been relieved before dawn. We'd been there all day, you see. We used to do a night and a day. And we should have been relieved after dark. This was the mob never turned up. And it got to daylight. We found out then that they arrived, and there'd been another one nearby, Yulan Farm, only about 200 yards away. But they thought that was the right place, and then found out it wasn't. You'd only map coordinates to go by, and there was no landmarks left at all. So that meant that we got to get away, and it was no longer in darkness. We crawled the best we could until we got to the road, and then it was a corduroy road. Well, of course, Jerry had it under observation. It took us about 3 hours to get back to the battery, because every time we moved, we had field guns on us, you see. And by then we were thoroughly fed up, and had one man called Boiling, who was a Londoner. I don't know where he came from as a reinforcement, but he was a well-educated man. He played for Blackheath rugby team, remember that. And when we got back to our battery, they were in action, and he just walked up to a gun which was ready to fire and pushed the man out the way, got onto the lanyard, gave it a jerk and fired the gun. And the number two on the gun looked at him a bit amazed. And Bubbles, as we called him, turned around and said, "I hope that hits some bugger in the back of the neck." So...
Sorry, I thought you'd finished.
Oh. Well, while we were there, we used to see these dogfights in the evening up above, you know, with the aeroplanes. Watched them evening after evening, to watch them with binoculars. And there was one came down, fell behind us, actually in Ypres, you see. He was on fire, Jerry, and one wing dropped off, you see. And then the second wing dropped off. And he came down, this is like a torch, like that. And I always remember one of the chaps sat near me just said, "Poor bugger," just like that, you know. Because it just landed, I should say, about 150 yards from us, over the ramparts, on the cobblestones in Ypres, mm-hmm. And it smashed clean through those cobblestones into the ground.
Now, I know in September 1917 you came under attack from enemy gas shells for the first time. What was that like?
Well, there's no great noise about it, because there's only sufficient explosive in the shell to open it up. The shell itself is filled with liquid gas. The nose is spigoted into the cylinder part and held on with either lead or rivets or wooden pegs. And in the bottom there's a bursting charge which compresses it enough to shear those rivets and allow the gas to come out as a liquid and it evaporates like that, you see. I just got back to the battery that night at about midnight, and that moment it started. Well, we were very, very short of men, and they were inexperienced men too, so I started doing the line mending myself. Not with any great hope, because I'd six lines out from the battery to adjacent batteries to the observation post exchange in the ramparts behind, and to the brigade headquarters, but all those lines were broken within a few minutes, and I never once got any communication with anybody outside. And they kept that up until 7 o'clock in the morning.
Look, let's go back to this gas attack itself, because as far as you were concerned, it was the first gas attack, and therefore was a new experience for you. Could you describe it in a little more detail for me? I mean, how did it differ from normal
shell
attacks?
Well, there wasn't any great danger from splinters or explosives or anything like that. All that was happening around you, hearing these thuds and plops, you know, and the clouds of vapour rolling about, you see. You couldn't see that much in a gas mask, you know, and all I was doing was crawling about with the lines, but following by feel as much as anything, you see.
Yeah. How much casualties did the gas attack cause?
Very, very heavy. Because a lot of the chaps in the dugouts were getting it worse than I was in the open, because the gas is heavy, you see, and sinks in the dugout, you see, and they're getting it worse than I was, I suppose. And also, I'd got a new box respirator, you see, that had been replaced, so that the life of the box was so many hours, you see, I don't remember how many, but they didn't last indefinitely, you see, and mine was a new one. So it got on your chest to some extent. But with a Jew boy there, who was the RMC orderly attached to the battery, I never knew him by any other name but Ikey. He was sort of a loner as far as the battery was concerned. He'd mend your clothes or anything like that and not want any money for it, you know, very obliging chap. He'd cut your hair. And yes, I sometimes feel guilty about it. Nobody made a friend of him, really. And that chap was taking blinded men, you know, with his mustard gas, to a dressing station in Ypres. One lot after another, and he came back on from one occasion, and a shell had pitched in this, it was in a cavalry barracks, I think, it pitched in the parade yard, and about 70 casualties more amongst the wounded men. But when he'd finished taking them all away, I don't think there was above 30 of us left, out of about 100.
Did this gas attack more effectively limit your battery's operations than the conventional shell attacks had?
It stopped us, you see, we hadn't sufficient men to carry on.
Yeah.
And
why did it stop you, do you think? Was it due to the inadequacies of your equipment? What kind of equipment did you have to deal with gas? You mentioned a box respirator.
Oh, yes, but I mean, the point is that you'd so few men that you couldn't man the five guns we'd got. We'd only, as I say, less than 30 men left, in officers and everybody. We did a bit of firing, I don't remember, but we were due to be pulled out, you see, straight away. But before we could be pulled out, he repeated the dose 5 days later, on the 10th.
It sounds as if the effectiveness of the gas was due to the surprise that it caused, that you hadn't been expecting it, and you weren't really equipped to combat it.
The only thing is that the gas will burn, you see, apart from the respirator only protected your lungs, it didn't protect your body if you got burns or anything, you see. I don't know what happened to all the men. I mean, I was so busy at the time, and they were just taking these fellas away. If a man wasn't fit for duty, they took him away, you see. That's all. A lot of them would recover, I've no doubt. But we were short-handed. Mm. And so on the 10th, they say, he repeated the dose, and then it would be a few days later, we were relieved by another battery. I've forgotten who it was now.
Did rats cause much of a problem for you?
They used to pinch your rations at night. They did gnaw through your anything you put them in, unless it was in a metal container, they'd get at it. But the gas attack shifted a lot of them, because after the attack had finished, when we got saw in the morning, there was dozens and dozens of these rats crawling about on their bellies, and we were just stubbing your toe underneath them and landing them in the moat, in the water. But there were two swans which lived on the moat there, and they were up on the ramparts, apparently unharmed.
When the gas didn't do the job of getting rid of the rats for you, Were there any particular methods you yourself used to adopt?
No, with nothing. Never. And yet, the thing which amazes me in that area, we had two men in the battery, Staten and Levick, who were professional poachers, I think. They were down in the books as mine, but they're professional poachers. But I saw one of those bring a rabbit in from that area for the officer's mess and got 5 francs for it. Where the hell he got a rabbit in this area, I just don't imagine.
And when you moved south for the Battle of Cambrai, did you move as a complete battery?
All except the guns. We left those in position for the battery which took over from us, you see.
Was this standard procedure?
No. And it was too dangerous to try and get them out and put others back in. It was just exposing you, both units, to unnecessary risks. Mm. You might as well just leave them where they were. Because after all, it was a standard gun.
Mm.
And we didn't have any particular affection for any particular gun because ours was replaced about every month. The rate they wore them out, the piece, that is the actual barrel of the gun, weighs 42 hundredweights. That was replaced.
Well, when you got to Cambrai, now for the battle there in which the tanks played such a major role, did you have to adapt your methods according to the tanks that you had to work with?
Not our batteries, but we were doing the usual thing, you know, counter battery work and that sort of thing.
Mm.
We went down to Villers-Forken first, and from there was a general... General Knapp, K-N-A-P-P, he came to inspect us, and he had a medical officer with us, and said that very few of the men were really fit for duty. So we were sent down to Cerisi on a rest for a fortnight. We NCOs were in charge of squads of Jerry prisoners, doing repair and construction work on this camp, which were enlarging, you see. And then one morning, one of the chaps came to me and says, pack up. I said, what for? I said, we're going back up the line. One of the men in my hut the night before, he'd been on a booze. We couldn't wake him in the morning. A chap called Cox. And eventually, we sent for the medical chap and he came. Took him away, and by 11 o'clock he was dead with yellow fever. So I suppose I thought, if we got yellow fever, we might as well go up the line and die down there. And so back we went up the line straight away. We went up to, first to Epey, E-P-E-H-Y. I went up there with two men to arrange for communications, you see. And I found a cellar, it was in ruins of course, I found a cellar which we could use. And then the ration wagon came up with stuff for us, and we passed a battery which was loading, fusing shells, a 6-inch battery. And there was a latrine there, and I thought, we'll just call in there for a minute, you see. We got to the top of the road, round the corner, there was a huge explosion, it blows off our feet. And what had happened, when Jerry had gone back earlier in the year, he'd left one of these delayed mines with the wire eaten through by acid, you see, and it'd gone up just then, right under this lot, under the latrine where we'd been. And this one of them, Steno, says, good job, you only wanted a piss, isn't it? If we'd stopped any longer, we should have gone up with it.
Can we concentrate now for a moment about the way in which artillery methods changed in the last 2 years of the war, the way they developed, as compared with the earlier period, in your experience? And start off by considering how your work against the movement of enemy supplies was affected by the introduction of harassing fire. Could you tell me what the technique of harassing fire was and why it was an improvement?
Well, as the term implies, the object is to put as much obstacle as possible in the way of the enemy getting supplies up. You want to deny him as many routes as possible. If you concentrate on the roads only, as we're doing at one time, road junctions were thought to be very important, you see, which they were, of course. Where the ground was hard, it could go across country with the wagons or horses, something like that, pack horses. So we started a different method of this harassing fire. The battery would take a section, an oblong as a rule, and the adjoining batteries in the brigade would take the adjoining sections, so that every part of the approach to the front line was covered. And each battery would, each gun would have a lane in that oblong. And the guns would fire independently, say two rounds a minute, something like that, or maybe only one round a minute, just depending if there's much traffic moving. You would alter your range on your gun every time, so that in the area which you were covering, no one could say where the next shell would fall, so that they couldn't take a particular route and say, well, we're safe there. They weren't. They never knew where they were going to be hit. And 160-pounder shell landing on open ground can do an awful lot of damage, especially with the later type fuses that were given, see? Mm. Because the earlier direct action fuse, the 44, had a fifth of a second delay, which meant that it went in the ground and dislodged several tons of earth without doing a fat lot of damage. But the later one had the 106 fuse, and that had a cap on the top of it, a safety cap, which had to be removed, a split pin withdrawn and the cap removed. That left a sort of a blunt-headed nail, cup-headed nail, with a bit of brass tape wound round it, and the tab end was left sticking out, and it was wound in the direction opposite to the rifling of the gun, so that when the shell left the gun, the air tore off that strip and left the nail loose. Well, the detonator inside was fulminate of mercury. When the shell landed, it acted so that the shell burst on the open without going in the ground, and the blast was directed practically horizontally over a fairly wide area.
I see. Now, another introduction in 1917, as far as your battery was concerned, was wireless for the first time. How were wirelesses used when they were introduced into your battery? For what purposes?
Receiving information from the planes.
Yeah.
From observation.
Did the introduction of wireless represent an improvement in any way?
Oh, yes.
What was the advantage?
Well, the plane could see, obviously, much further than you could from the ground. And particularly on